This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and when I start my workday, it always begins with that morning shower. Normally, I use a liquid body wash, but recently I purchased a bar of Sterling Soap Company's handcrafted bath soap and decided to give their Deep Blue Sea handcrafted bath soap a try. Immediately, the aroma of Sterling's bath soap was obvious, and in using this soap, I felt refreshed, clean, energized, and Sterling's bath soap helped me step out of that shower with the momentum and eagerness to get my day rolling. If you want to get a refreshing wake-up call in the morning and get your busy day off to the right start, I highly recommend going to Sterling Soap Company's website and order one of their many varieties of bath soaps among other products they offer. Visit Sterling Soap Company at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
Welcome to the Statman and Robin podcast. We are the dynamic duo of Baltimore sports history. I am Jim Johnson, the Statman, with my partner, Robin Haynes. Robin, how's everything going?
Doing great, Statman. I mean, Jim.
I'll answer to either one.
You know, you call somebody by a certain name for close to 60 years.
It gets to be a habit, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, for this podcast, as we're getting into the time of year for NFL training camps, and let's call them the games they play before the games count, because there's a whole another history with the terminology exhibition game, which we remember that terminology well. With the games they played before the season started, and then the terminology that's supposed to be used today.
It's rebranded.
Yes, it's almost like it's politically correct to say preseason instead of exhibition. And I did actually look up something. The NFL strongly encourages the use of preseason.
They do.
So if you're you know, if you're in the media or whatever and you slip up and say exhibition, I don't know, the NFL is probably going to find a way to slap your hand a little bit there.
Yes, we'll be strongly encouraged not to do that. Yes, exactly.
We know how the league works. Yeah. So we're going to get into the Baltimore Colts history with training camp and exhibition games. But first, I wanted to talk about the Baltimore Ravens. Because the Ravens made kind of some NFL history of a different kind by being the first team that was featured on Hard Knocks.
Oh, yeah.
Hard Knocks was produced by HBO Sports, and the very first season was during the summer of 2001. And the NFL was behind it because they wanted to get into reality TV. That was becoming more and more of a thing. So they wanted to get on the bandwagon there. And the Ravens, of course, had just come off their win in Super Bowl 35 in January of 2001. So the Ravens themselves, the organization, they definitely wanted to put themselves even more in the spotlight. They basically kind of are in the NFL consciousness, I guess you could say, by winning that Super Bowl. And being the first team on Hard Knocks was going to, you know, raise that profile even more.
Well, they had a lot of guys that loved the camera, too.
Exactly. We had some big personalities that got a lot of screen time. Really, Shannon Sharp and Tony Siragusa were the two main guys.
Don't forget Coach Billick.
Well, Coach Billick was another guy. And interesting thing about Billick, he was really behind it because in his resume, he had a public relations job in his resume.
Oh, yeah.
Before he was coaching. Yep. So he knew what this could do for the Ravens' profile. And another thing he wanted was authenticity. There was a lot of discussion about Now, granted, this is on cable, so profanity wasn't as big a deal, but there was a lot of discussion about limiting the profanity that was used in the show. And Billick was saying, "No way. We're going to be who we are. I'm going to be who I am," because he admitted that it was a big part of his vocabulary. And he knew it would be kind of fake if they cut back on it. And plus, it just let everybody be themselves. And there were some previously there had been some similar things that might have been produced by local NFL TV markets, talking about training camp, and they always focused on the drama of the rookies and are they going to be cut, are they not going to be cut? There was inherent drama there, and Hard Knocks definitely focused on that, but they went way beyond what had ever been covered before in this type of programming. Another interesting thing I found out was, the Ravens had three assistants. They had Marvin Lewis, defensive coordinator, Rex, and two of his assistants, Rex Ryan and Jack Del Rio. Those three guys in particular were very much in favor of themselves being mic'd up. They had no objection, and a lot of people were saying, or maybe looking back on that, they were probably thinking, "I want to be a head coach someday."
Yeah, they were auditioning.
Exactly. So if I'm
It
mic'd up
worked.
and I get my camera time, that's going to help me. And hey, all three of those guys eventually became head coaches. So Hard Knocks certainly didn't help their cause there. Also, one of the ground rules was the trainer's room was considered a safe haven. So no filming or microphones, nothing like that could be in the trainer's room. So the players did kind of have an area, as a safe area where they could, they wanted to say anything they wanted. They didn't have to worry about it being on camera. Now, that training camp in Westminster, Maryland, at Western Maryland College, which the Baltimore Colts had used for their training camp for many, many years. After winning that Super Bowl, you can imagine the mob scene in terms of the number of people that wanted to go to training camp. I mean, I took my own family up there one day. What a mob scene. That little college.
I went up with you one time. I think
Yes.
it was that year or the next year
It might
after
have been
in
the
Yale.
year after. Right, exactly. I remember you were there once. They weren't built to handle the crowds that they ended up getting. Another interesting thing in the history of HBO Sports, the first season of Hard Knocks has the highest ratings ever for them to this day, except for bo some boxing events. Other
Oh, I
than that,
mean, all sports broadcasts, not just the Hard Knocks episodes.
well, it's for HBO Sports,
Yeah, but I mean, still, they've carried a lot of stuff.
So, yeah, that kind of covers Hard Knocks in 2001.
Well, that
And
was a good show. You got to admit, they put on a good show.
I think there were a few years where it kind of fell by the wayside and then they revived it. And there's some, different permutations of it these days, I think. But again, the Ravens have the honor of being the first.
And the best, I think we
Exactly.
can
A lot of
say.
people say that. A lot of
Well, the
people have
numbers
said
back it
that
up.
first season was the best. And interestingly enough, exactly 30 years earlier, in the summer of 1971, of course, we still have the Baltimore Colts in Baltimore, and they were coming off their win in Super Bowl V the previous January. And ABC carried a one-hour special that summer called Plimpton, the Great Quarterback Sneak. So when I said Plimpton, if you're of a certain age, you know who I'm talking about. If you don't know who George Plimpton was, a very fascinating guy, just put it that way.
He did a lot of stuff.
Yes, But what he's most well known for is the idea of participatory journalism. As a journalist, you don't just observe and interview, you actually become part of the story and become part of, in this case, in his case, multiple sports. He actually, in 1963, he was part of the Detroit Lions training camp and was technically, a quarterback on their way down
Technically.
the depth chart, let's put it that way.
Yes.
He wrote a book about that experience called Paper Lion, which came out, I think, a few years after he actually did the training camp. And then they made a movie about it a couple years after that, I believe in 68. So he had done this before, and basically he did the same thing with the Colts that he did with the Lions. But this was a TV special, again, for ABC. So ABC at that time, you have to remember, the season before was the first season of Monday Night Football, and that was on ABC. ABC was trying to raise their profile related to all things NFL. And
Well,
I
because they
think
were the third network at that time. They were raising their
exactly.
profile in general.
Exactly. And a lot of people didn't think Monday Night Football was going to be the big hit that it was. And ABC was trying to build on that. I think it was a smart move on their part. I think that's another thing that, another reason that ABC gave the green light to this special. They wanted people to think ABC, hey, NFL. So in the Great Quarterback Sneak, basically, Plimpton was a participant in training camp. He learned some basic plays. He did interview multiple players. He did get a few minutes with Johnny Unitas. It didn't hurt that Johnny U was in this thing, because George Plimpton kind of was making the connection. Like, here I am trying to, take a stab at playing quarterback, and I get to rub elbows kind of with the greatest ever. And Plimpton did actually play in one exhibition game against the Detroit Lions, interestingly enough. He ran four plays at the end of the first half in an actual exhibition game. Didn't go too well. There was one pass play in there that got batted down, and the receiver was open. He really wished he could have that one back. But if anybody listened to the podcast, if you want to check it out, it's right there on YouTube. It's pretty interesting. And kind of moving on from that,
Well, I wanted to mention one other thing real quick, Rob. As I was watching that, I kept having a thought in my mind. I just can't even conceive of Don Shula going for that whole exercise
good
with George
point.
Plimpton. Can
Good
you?
point.
Because
Because
Don
Don was
McCafferty
traveling.
actually sat and spent some time with Plimpton during
Yes, he
training camp,
did.
him and the coaches. Oh my gosh. And Shula would have, well, he would have made it clear that the whole thing was not welcome. And
Exactly.
McCafferty was just, yeah, come on. He woke that's the kind of guy Don McCafferty was.
You're right.
And
I
didn't
forgot about
exactly hurt the team's prep, did it?
Right. Yeah, I had forgotten about Don McCafferty. He was known, his nickname given to him by the players, following up on the famous movie that had just come out not too long before that. His nickname was Easy Rider.
Well earned.
He was known to be, not a hard-nosed head coach. Let's just put it that way. But the players loved him, apparently. So as we get into the actual exhibition game history of the Baltimore Colts, that would cover the period from 1953 through 1983. Some interesting things there. So you have to remember, from the Colts' beginnings, there were only 12 regular season games through 1960. So you have 12 regular season games, but you played five or six exhibition games every year. But they basically, even when the regular season total went up to 14 games per year, started in 1961 through 1977, they still played five or six exhibition games every year. And thinking about today's game, there's a lot of talk about the wear and tear on the players' bodies, with a 17-game season that it is now. Well, you know what? Back then, I mean, even when there were only 12 regular season games, you're playing six exhibition games. That comes out to 18.
Right, and the starters played a lot more back then because there were no OTAs or anything. A lot of these guys wandered off at the end of the season and you didn't see them again until training camp. So they were actually playing themselves into shape. Whereas now, if you show up for that first day of training camp and you're not already in shape, you're in deep trouble and you're probably not going to make the team unless you're already a star. So they needed actually, it sounds ridiculous to have that many preseason games. And you and I had talked about that earlier, but it's like, well, if you're using it to actually play these guys instead of having the OTAs, the optional team activities, which sometimes are not optional, then maybe it all kind of washed out, and that way the owners could actually charge for tickets for watching it instead of just getting together at your camp. So it kind of made sense, but obviously with a 17 and probably soon to be 18 game schedule, you can't do that because you're taking care of the players and the OTAs anyway.
I think also when you look at the amount of money that is invested in the players today, reducing the injury risk is, just such a big deal.
Exponentially greater.
So again, with the Colts exhibition history, they basically maintained, like I said, five or six games a year, even with a 14-game schedule. But when they went to 16 games per year, like most teams around the league, then they went to four preseason games. But if you look at the overall history while the Colts were in Baltimore, they played 164 exhibition games with a record of 91, 69, and 4. But here's the thing that really got me. They only played 24 out of 164 games in Baltimore. And in many seasons, they played no games, no exhibition games in Baltimore.
Well, let me follow up on that because I did a little bit of analysis during that stretch because 1962 to 1970, no home games. Ironically enough, they had two long winning streaks during that stretch. We heard all about the Ravens' record 24 game winning streak over 7 years. They
Yeah,
won
you know how
13.
I felt about
Yes, a couple of bucks will get you a cup of coffee, maybe.
Yes,
But they've
so
won
what?
13 in a row from 1964 to 67 and 11 in a row from 1968 to 1970. None of those games were played in Baltimore.
Wow, interesting.
I don't know that that really tells you anything, but it's just sort of odd, Then they started playing home games and losing them. So but again, it's pre-exhibition slash preseason, so who cares? But it's good fodder to talk about when you get those kind of oddities pop up.
Well, with the Colts playing so many of these exhibition games away from home, a lot of emphasis today is placed on how many travel miles is the team projected to have on their schedule. And, sometimes, people think that can be a difference maker. Boy, those Colts players, they had to be sick of travel before the regular season it had even started. And they
Now,
were
I'm
all over
looking
the
at that
country.
stretch, and they would play a game every 2 or 3 years out, past the central time zone. But for the life of me, Rob, I've never understood to this day why an Eastern team would play on the West Coast in preseason and vice versa, but it happens regularly. Why would you do that? Especially the East Coast teams. There's plenty of teams around. I don't get that because that's not cheap moving all that equipment.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you look at the travel costs alone. I mean,
Yeah. But anyway, greater minds than ours, right? Allegedly, maybe.
yeah, I wonder if there are any folks in Lincoln, Nebraska, or Tempe, Arizona, or Raleigh, North Carolina. I think you mentioned
Yeah.
before. Just some examples of non-NFL cities that got to have the Baltimore Colts come to their town and play exhibition football.
Right. Well, there was Norfolk. There was New Orleans before the Saints. Roanoke.
Yeah.
In the early 60s, several games in good old Hershey, Pennsylvania.
Ah, that's true. That's true. They were just all over the place.
You really were.
Another memory I have of those days, when I was, old enough to kind of know more what was going on. I remember Bob Irsay when he owned the team. He took over the team in '72 as owner, and seems like not too long after that, he was already making noise from time to time about possibly moving the Colts. But I, again, my memory is that Irsay took the Colts during exhibition season on the road to kind of dangle his franchise in front of that city, saying, "Hey, wouldn't you like a nice NFL team to come play in your city, and because I'm, not so sure I'm happy in Baltimore." But the reality is, way before Bob Irsay came along, they were playing exhibitions away from Baltimore as, a general rule.
Now, what I found, that was the question that I had in my mind is why did that happen? Because that went back to the early 60s, and that was really before Rosenblum was really starting to rattle the Sabres about wanting a new stadium. And apparently, they were having major scheduling issues with the Orioles and Memorial Stadium. You remember, the Orioles and Colts did not get along well.
Right. Yeah, I know
And
that was a big issue.
that Monday night game, I guess it was the 1970 game, was I think it was the second Monday night game ever.
It
And so
was.
that was still during the baseball season. And they had this crazy thing that they had to move the whole field up to where they weren't covering the pitcher's mound. So the other end of the field was practically on the center field fence. I think they had to take the fence down to get the whole field out there. And there was some concern of whether they would have to transfer the game to Kansas City. So, yeah, I think that was a big part of that issue, at least in the 60s, that the teams just really didn't connect all that well. And
Right.
the Memorial Stadium management was regarded to favor the Orioles, which, if you think about it, 81 dates versus maybe
Exactly.
8, 10 dates max.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Even though back then, Baltimore was definitely more of a Colts and a football
Oh,
town
yeah.
than baseball. But another interesting thing looking at the calendar with these exhibition games, I'll just use the first year the Colts were in Baltimore as an example. They played six exhibition games. They didn't play the first one until August 15th, and the final exhibition game out of six was on September 20th. But again, it's a 12-game schedule.
Right.
We just can't wrap our heads around that
I
in terms
know.
of the modern way it's done now, I guess you would say.
Well, even in the 14-game schedule, we would go back to school and they were still playing exhibition games.
Yeah, exactly. Because typically it was not until after Labor Day you saw the first regular season game.
Yeah, well, we're going back to 1971. The last preseason game was September 11th.
Wow.
So they started the regular season the next weekend. So yeah, and then before that, on the 12-game season, it was usually around the last weekend of September before they started. Which, can you even imagine that now? But
Wow.
yeah,
I
because
can't.
they gradually moved it up. So it'd be interesting to see what they do if when they add the 18-game schedule, if they'll start it on Labor Day weekend,
Right.
which I think they did for a short time with the 16-game schedule.
Yes, I do remember that. I do, and I remember If I'm not mistaken, it was kind of a big deal because that first Monday night football game of the season was on Labor
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah, right. So going back to some of the again, Ravens history related to training camp, preseason. When the Ravens came to Baltimore in '96, they did resume the tradition of holding training camp in Westminster at Western Maryland College. It's actually called McDaniel College these days. I think it's been that way for over 20 years. And there was a lot of, that helped in terms of goodwill with this new franchise coming to town.
Oh,
They wanted
yeah.
to resume that old Colts tradition. And they maintained that training camp location until the 2011 season. And I kind of remember, a lot of people were unhappy when the Ravens decided to move training camp from Westminster to Owings Mills, to the actual Ravens year-round, basically, training facility in Owings Mills, Maryland. But that decision, what really kind of forced the Ravens' hand a little bit was because in the spring of 2011, there was a labor disagreement between the players' union and the league, and basically a lockout was going on. And the West in Westminster, basically, the motel that the players used, and of course the college itself, they wanted a commitment from the Ravens, like, hey, are you guys coming here this summer? Because we need to know. We need to book other things if you're not going to be here. And the Ravens really couldn't commit because they didn't know when training camp was going to start, when preseason was going to start, all of that. So I guess you can't fault the Ravens too much on that. But there was some, lingering hard feelings for a good while
Yeah,
because a lot of
I
people felt
remember.
like the tradition.
And the
Of
economy in Westminster, Maryland.
what's that?
The economy in Westminster, Maryland really hurt too.
Yes.
They
Yeah,
were good
there were a
business
lot
in
of
August.
unhappy
They were
people.
big business.
But Jim, I think you have some other nuggets of information
Well, yeah, and
regarding
just to kind
preseason.
of finish this discussion on a sobering note. Now, one of the things that coaches always talk about, because the starters a lot of times do not play at all in preseason. And well, we don't want people to get injured, right? Well, the Colts got bit very badly by that twice in the 70s. In 1972, this had been something, this is right after Irsay had taken over the Colts, but something that Carol Rosenblum had already put into place. They did their camp down in Tampa, and they played the games. And this is before 4 years, 5 years, 4 years before the Tampa Bay Bucs were in place. So, and as I remember, they drew pretty well down there. They played three home games there in 72. But since they didn't normally get NFL games, they did not have trained support staff for those games. So what happened was in one of the games, it was I forget which one it was, but one of the 1972 games, Bubba Smith, the superstar defensive end who was still close to the peak of his powers,
Sure.
was making a tackle and he came over to the sideline. Now, the standard procedure was for the chain gang that holds the 10-yard chain, which literally is a chain still, to measure the first down from the initial line of scrimmage, is supposed to drop the chain so it's loose and no one's going to get injured over it. And at that time, they stuck the chains in the ground. They were hard metal, solid metal markers that
Right.
held these up. Well, these guys doing holding the chains there kind of freaked out when Bubba Smith was running at them, and they backed up, and the chain was still there, and Smith got his knee tangled up in it. The marker did not give because it was solid metal, and tore multiple ligaments in one of his knees. He missed that entire season and was never, he was a shell of the player he used to be after that. Because knee injuries, we've talked about this before. I think knee injuries back in the 60s and 70s were very, very bad things for your career. The medicine has improved remarkably since then. Now, very shortly after that, the NFL put in a rule, because they love putting in rules, but this was actually a good one, where they made it basically a plastic marker that if you hit it, it was going to snap and was not going to offer any resistance to that. And it's still the type they use to this day. So they ought to call it the Bubba Smith. I don't want to say he has passed away, but I want to say the Memorial Bubba Smith marker. But definitely from that injury, they did at least learn an important lesson. So nobody is going to have that type of injury again. But it ruined his career. He had several good years, but he probably had several more left.
No, that was such a shame. If I'm not mistaken, Bubba Smith sued the league over this incident.
I'm pretty sure he did.
Don't
They
remember
probably settled.
the outcome. I think, what's that?
They probably settled.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there was a settlement because the league wanted to make that whole thing go away
Yes.
as
Well,
quickly as
they're big
possible.
on making things go away whenever they can. But actually, the more impactful injury to the franchise happened in 1978, the last preseason game of the season. Al Baker of the Detroit Lions hit Burt Jones, and Burt was still at the top of his game, had led three straight division titles, had won the league MVP the year before last in 76, and separated his throwing shoulder. That to this day is still not a good injury for a quarterback. It was a really bad injury for a quarterback in 78. He missed several games, came back in a game, Monday night game you and I attended against the Redskins, which I'm sure that will be the top, that game will be the topic of an upcoming podcast. That,
Definitely.
yeah. But that was basically Burt Jones's last hurrah. And he was never the same after that, nor were the Colts. In fact, in my mind, that play ended that era of success. And statistically, it did. The Colts never had a winning record after that. Best they did, I think, was 6-7-9.
7-9, I think.
Yeah. Burt came back. He played some games. He got re-injured again in 79. I think he missed most, if not all, the season then. And then he was able to play most of the games subsequent to that before he was traded to the Rams. And then he had a career-ending neck injury that finished him off. But he was never that star from 75 to 77 that was arguably the best quarterback in the NFL, certainly one of them.
He was
So,
definitely in the conversation.
yeah. So it's not just blowing smoke when coaches are concerned about injuries. There have been some franchise-altering injuries happen in preseason, and I can't think there might be one. Maybe our listeners can send us an email at statmanandrobin@gmail.com and let us know if they can think of a bigger one that altered the direction of the franchise. Now, and I don't know how good the Colts would have been in 78. And the first two games without Burt, they got totally annihilated and embarrassed, including an opening Monday night game against the Cowboys. That was bad timing. Seemed like it would have been a great idea with Burt Jones versus Roger Staubach, but with Mike Kirkland versus Roger Staubach, wasn't a great idea.
Yeah, and I've heard it said about Burt Jones, a lot of contemporaries, players and coaches said this guy had the biggest arm they'd ever seen in any quarterback.
Oh man, the
And
Ruskin rifle.
yes, but because of that, his arm at 100% versus after getting injured, and let's just say his arm was at 60%, because his injury-free throwing ability was what it was. That's really the only reason he was able to come back and play half decently at all.
That's a
Because he
great
still,
point.
him at 60% was still a stronger arm than a lot of
Say, let's say Billy Kilmer gets hit like that, he's done.
guys. Yeah,
Because his arm at full strength was 60% of Burt Jones's.
Yeah, a lot of people would joke about the wounded ducks that he would
Yes.
throw. But
End
I don't
over
know what's
end,
going
call a fair catch. Yeah, those kind of things.
Yeah, what's a
So,
step down from a wounded duck? I can't even imagine what
I don't, a dead duck, I guess.
Yeah, right, not wounded, dead.
Yes, it's done. So, well, I
Yeah.
think that's going to wrap up everything we have today. We want to keep these podcasts to a listable length. Could we go on another half hour? Oh, you betcha. But we fit the highlights, I think, that we wanted to, and I think we'll call it a broadcast. Rob, how about you?
Sounds good. And I know that we've promised our listeners and those viewing the podcast that we're going to talk about some obscure stuff. And we certainly delivered today.
We are delivering, man. We call us mailmen because we are delivering. So, with apologies to Carl Malone there. So, well, thanks, Rob. We hope our listeners have enjoyed this episode of the Stat Man and Robin podcast. And again, if you have any questions, thoughts, or feedback, you can email us at statmanandrobin@gmail.com. Remember, it's good to look back as long as you live forward. Thanks for listening, everyone.
See ya.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.